All right, we're going to be looking tonight at beginning at Nehemiah chapter 9, and we'll begin that in just a moment. But before we get started with this, let's take a moment. Let's go to God in prayer. Stand up, missing that, please. You know, we're talking about leadership, and one of the greatest lessons is the importance of leadership and developing those qualities as much as we can within ourselves. You know, I'm thinking about Old Testament history, which I've been using as our foundation through Nehemiah, but you know, you had, at the death of Solomon, the kingdom divided into two nations. You had Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And neither one of them were very good throughout their history, but Israel went into captivity 135 years before Judah. And I think that, you know, there are other things that may have been involved, but one of the keys was that in Judah, from time to time, you had men like Asa. And I know Asa, at the end of his life, didn't trust the Lord. But for most of his life as king, he was serving the Lord. You had Jehoshaphat. You had Uzziah. You had Josiah. You had, from time to time, good, strong leaders in Judah. In Israel, you didn't have a single good king. And you had some men, you know, like Jeroboam and Omri and Ahab and others. Leadership is vital. God's put leadership in the home. And I will say this, you know, there are wives who are wonderful Christians despite the failings of the husband as the leader of the family. There are going to be Christians who will serve the Lord faithfully if the leadership fails. I mean, their churches, they never develop any leadership. You know, it's not a situation of, you don't have good leadership, you have zero. They'll go for years and years and years. There are no elders and really no men who lead. And yet there are people who do what they should. But we all know it works better in the home. It works better in the church when it's what God wants it to be and we have good leadership. We're talking about Nehemiah. What was the major task that we associate with Nehemiah that he accomplished? The rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. Remember, they were destroyed about 586 B.C. And even though the people had come back and rebuilt the temple, the city still was pretty much defenseless until Nehemiah came back about 445 and led the people in rebuilding the temple. And I wanted just to review a few of the key traits of Nehemiah. I thought about a more extensive review tonight because of the fact that it's been 3 weeks since we've been together, but I want to keep it moving. These are not all the points. I've given you each week, tried to go back and give you the papers that summarize the leadership points from the week before, but Nehemiah had faith in God. That just stands out. His trust in God. There are several times he reflects a knowledge of the Scriptures. And I don't know, you know, how widely available copies were. But Nehemiah reflects a knowledge of the Scriptures. He spends so much time in prayer. The references to prayer, about pray without ceasing. That was one of the qualities of Nehemiah. And his concern for the people. You know, the term that used to be used for politics would be public service. How many of us really feel like that the guys that run for office today are, you know, they go off to Washington as relatively, you know, people of middle class income. By the time they leave Washington, you know, they're part of, as they like to say, the 1%. You know, they're millionaires. And we, you know, that's, and I'm not saying that's all of them, but that's a common feeling. Well, the leaders of God's people are concerned about people. They're undeterred by opposition. It's not a, Nehemiah faced opposition within, without, and you're kind of jumping down to the bottom when Nehemiah didn't ignore the problems. He dealt with them. There were internal problems. There were external problems. He dealt with those problems, and part of that, and we're going to emphasize this a little more tonight, he knew how to plan and organize. I think he had to have been a quite inspirational character. The way that he came back and just immediately got the people going and got them started. But it was more than just kind of working up an excitement. Nehemiah planned, he organized, he did a good job with things. That's what we've seen in the first 8 chapters. But before we pick up chapter 9, any questions, comments before we move along? Okay, well, look at, if you remember in chapter 8, they had read the law, they had realized their sin, but they were told, no, look, right now is the time to rejoice. They kept the Feast of Tabernacles. And now in chapter 9, we're going to come back and they're going to deal with the problems. Let's read the first 3 verses. If you would, Mike, how about reading 9, 1 through 3? All right. So, you know, here they are. They come together and they first of all, this time they're fasting. They've been rejoicing. You know, they'd had the Feast of Tabernacles and it was just a great time. Now they fast, separate themselves from the foreigners, verse 2. That is a recurring problem. We'll see it again in chapter 13. This lack of the sense of the holy nation of God that is separate, not to marry, not to be a part of that. They confess their sins. They confess the iniquities of their fathers. They read some more. Remember back in chapter 8, they were reading from the law. They read. They confessed and worshiped. In verse 3, the confession there, I don't think it's the same as confessing the sins of verse 2. I think this is confessing the name of the Lord, praising Him, professing Him. We've got this time of worship. Then, we're going to have a time of prayer. And we're not going to read all of the prayer. If we were studying Nehemiah just to be studying Nehemiah, which would be a profitable study, we would read all of it. We're studying Nehemiah for leadership, so we won't do all of it. Chad, I hate to give you verse 5, but if you'll read 5 through 7, I could have given you verse 4 also, so be thankful.
Okay.
All right. We're not going to read all the thing. I just want to get, this is sort of the flavor of it. It's praise to God, exalting God, praising Him over and over again, praising Him as the one who chose Abraham, who gave the covenant. Then, a lot of it is, Lord, You've been a lot more merciful to us than we deserved. Throughout our history, we have provoked You to wrath, we disobeyed You, and even though You've chastised us, You've never destroyed us. And so we are thankful for that. And then at the end, there's a plea for help and a promise that we're going to do better. Verse 32, and then jump down to 36 through 38. Amanda, are you where you can? Drop to 36.
Here we are, servants today, and the land that You gave to our fathers, to eat its fruit and its bounty, here we are, servants in it, and it yields much increase to the king. You have set over us because of our sin. And they have dominion over our bodies and our cattle at their pleasure, and we are in great distress. And because of all of this, we make a sure covenant and write it. Our leaders, our Levites, and our priests.
Yeah, I want you to note something. We didn't read 33, but it says, you are just in all that's befallen us. There's no complaining saying, oh, mistreated. But they pray and they said, take note of the trouble. Don't let it seem insignificant. And, you know, you look at verse 36 and 37. You know, here we are. Here's this land You gave our fathers. And boy, it yields a lot of increase to those that rule over us. We are not enjoying this. We are not, you know, they have dominion. It's because of our sins. So what are we going to do about it? We're going to make a covenant and write it, and our leaders, our Levites, our priests will seal it. You know, they're going to make the covenant, which we'll look at in chapter 10. That's the thrust of it. There are a few little lessons you could learn in it. But I do want you to take note in 13 and 14 that he makes reference to making known to them the Sabbath at Mount Sinai. If you're ever talking about the Sabbath with someone that says, well, that was God's eternal covenant, and, you know, from the beginning, from Genesis 2, God rested, and God did rest in Genesis 2 on the seventh day. Because when God made it known to man, it was there at Mount Sinai. Verse 17 is just a great, beautiful passage. You are God, ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger, abundant in kindness, and did not forsake them. Just, I just think that's a beautiful picture there of God. Well, what do we learn from this chapter leadership-wise? Well, something we keep coming back to. What is recognized in this prayer is our ultimately being blessed of God. And what I want leaders to understand is, if leaders are going to lead the church into the blessings of God, it's from serving God. I've made this statement before, and I'm going to make it again, and I might make it again. You know, a charismatic leader, he can fire people up. You know, leaders who are energetic, and, you know, bundle of fire. They get folks going, but they don't necessarily get them going in the Lord. If you're going to be a leader, now you're going to have to be energetic. I mean, you jump around, you know. I've said, I know all of you have probably heard Bill Hall preach. Bill has, you know, when he preaches, it's like I've read on TV where they say there's a little piece of tape down on the stage. You come out and find your mark. When Bill goes to the preach, he finds his mark. He moves out of his seat. You know, I'm all over the place. I just can't stand still. Yet, preaches with energy and passion. You know, see, there are different types of energy, but you've got to have energy. And to be a leader, I won't say you have to be charismatic, but you have to connect with people. You have to have that connection. You know, somebody can be the smartest, but if they're just kind of living up here in the clouds, or they just don't talk to people, they can't lead people. You know, energy, connection with people, those are important. But it starts with the connection to God. You've got to be a servant of God. And then, things in this. Leading the people to accept responsibility for their actions. That they were suffering. And yet, it's all about we are responsible. We made this mess, not you. And I don't know how to say it except leaders lead. 9:38, we make a sure covenant and write it. Our leaders, our Levites, and our feel it. The leaders step forward. And you know, we get to chapter 10, verse 1. The first name that goes on the document that commits them to the Lord is Nehemiah's name. And that's, you can't get people to do what you're not willing to do yourself. You know, that's just a key part of leadership. I feel bad in a way about leaving chapter 9 without talking more about it, but this is not a study of Nehemiah. It's a great chapter. I hope you've read it. If you haven't, go back and read it. Anybody else, anything on chapter 10 you want to say? Any of these thoughts? That's very, very. Yeah, and that comes from a lot of things. But that's right. You've got to convince the people. You cannot force, you know, to do it. They've got to be led to do it. Anybody else? I think that's a good, you know, back when beginning of the book, you remember how it talked about the rubble, the brick, the stones were burnt. He couldn't get his animal through here. The people were, but Nehemiah gave them hope and convinced them they could do it. That's right. All right, well, let's look at chapter 10. And let's see, who has not been nice to me? You read the first 27 verses. Okay, everybody's been nice. Let me tell you what. Verses 1 through 27 are the names of the people that put their seal on the document. We will just skip on down to verse 28. We will not go through all of that. The specific of the covenant. Let's look at those. And, you know, I want to... How about let's read 28 through 32, maybe break that about three verses each. Paul, Jennifer.
Now the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the Nethinim, and all those who separated themselves from the people of the land.
enough, I think, to get the sense. Look at verse 28, 29. We're going to come back to this a little bit later, but the rest of the people, and, you know, sons, wives, sons, daughters, everyone had enough. They joined with their brethren. This is, you know, I would say universal. You know, typically when it's got language like this, the rest of the people, there might be the exception. You know, that guy over there that didn't want to, but this is the people as a whole. And what do they do? They agreed to keep the law in general. You know, they just start off with the general observation. We will walk in God's law, the law that was given by Moses. Then he says, no intermarriage. That's a problem. That's the problem that started Solomon down the path toward evil. Then he says, we will respect the Sabbath, verse 31, both the weekly and the yearly Sabbath. We won't collect these debts, verse 31. Remember we had that problem back, chapter 5, was it? Then he said that we're going to support the house of God in verse 32. Then verse 34, we cast lots among the priests and the people for bringing the wood offering into the house of our God. If I'm not mistaken, this is the first time the Bible specifically mentions the wood offering. But have you ever stopped to think about how much wood was needed at Jerusalem? They're offering all these sacrifices. And, you know, the altar, it took a lot of wood. I mean, you would have soon exhausted the supply right around Jerusalem. You would have been bringing wood in from a distance, you know, to keep the fires burning. And so they took care of that. And then in 35 through 39, he said that basically it's a long discussion of, we were going to bring our offerings, our tithes, to support the Levites and the priest. And, you know, we'd make sure that the priests, the gatekeepers, the singers were taken care of. Verse 39, we will not neglect the house of our God. The tithe, you know, was clearly given unto God in a sense. Malachi 3:8. You know, would a man rob God? He said, you've robbed me in your tithes and your offerings. But the tithes and offerings specifically went to the priests and the Levites. And he said, we're going to take care of them. And so, again, as we keep saying, what do we learn leadership-wise? Well, again, leaders lead. This is something that, you know, is committing the people to do this, and Nehemiah is the first one to put his name on it. And there were other leaders. You know, I think about, and this goes to something I think that John was touching and what Brother Huggins really was saying. We talk about Nehemiah rebuilding the walls. Now, I think Nehemiah probably swung a few times, lifted a burden or two. Nehemiah didn't rebuild the walls, though. Nehemiah got the people to rebuild the walls. You know, with the help of God, you know, he inspired them, he motivated them. He did planning. That's what leadership, what we're looking for in leadership is the ability to, you know, get folks involved. And I skipped one of my points. Lead in the Lord, as we've been talking about. Nehemiah led the people back to God. It was always turning them toward God. Then the nation joined them. I just love this. You know, what it says, wives, sons, daughters, everyone who had knowledge and understanding. They were all involved in this. And do not neglect the house of God. Leadership is about service. It is about wanting to see God's house built up. In the very first chapter, we started this off, one of the points I made about Nehemiah, he was hundreds of miles from Jerusalem. What was going on in Jerusalem did not impact him directly. but he was concerned about his brethren. Then we saw him later, and he says, I didn't take the rations the governors before me had taken. You know, we talk about, I'm not sure just where he got all his support. You know, evidently the king continued to pay him enough than the people. And, you know, it was about serving them, leading them. And good leaders are concerned for building up the house of God, not their reputations, not their prestige. Any of you ever seen some of the old, you know, some of the older buildings, some of the congregations where they'd have the chairs up front, and there was some where the elders, and I mean, and you typically the chairs would have a back about this high, you know, like a throne, and in some of them, now sometimes what that would be, I've seen situations, the guy that lead the first prayer goes up there and he sits down until he's led the prayer, then he goes out to his seat. But there were places where the elders sat up there. You know, and there, I mean, it may not have originally been intended that way, but what does it look like? It looks like a couple of men sitting on thrones looking out over their subjects. You know, well, whether you mean it to be that way or not, that's not what leadership. Leadership is about building those people up, not ruling over them. The house of God, that's our priority. Thoughts on this, anything? Not hard to understand. That happens within the group, and it can happen within the leadership, particularly if a man doesn't have, is not well grounded, you know, have his feet on the ground, understand what this is about. This is about the house of God. And it is about serving the Lord. And, you know, and again, a charismatic leader can sweep people away. But we want to lead in the Lord. You know, need to do that. That's and if you wonder, if any of you wonder, well, why would he mention? You get into some questions about the Sabbath, and people argue. They will try to make a distinction between the law of God and the law of Moses, and there is no distinction. That's a good one to file away for that. But yeah, Nehemiah didn't tell people follow Nehemiah. He said follow the Lord. That is huge, and. That's, I think a preacher, you know, and we're almost human most of the time, you know. We got feelings, but preachers who are upset when somebody comes and questions, well, why did you say that? I don't think I agree with that point, or why did you say such and such? They've got the wrong attitude, Because our goal is to lead people to follow. You know, today it's a different. The law of God is not the law of Moses. But it's that. And as we're striving in that, you know, we better be willing to take the books out. Well, now this is why I said it. And they go, well, what about? And you go, oh, yeah. Can I back up? We all need a reverse. You know, because we're going to make some mistakes. And we need to be willing to get up and say, you know, I think I misspoke. I missed that passage. And that's got to be something we can do. I'll tell you, you do not diminish yourself as a leader and a person of influence if you occasionally admit to a mistake. None of us want to make mistakes, and we want to minimize those. And, you know, I say this especially in teaching and preaching. You put a lot of preparation into it, you'll make fewer. But we can all mess it up. You know, we can overlook something, and sometimes we can say things we didn't mean to say. You know, I had to correct something I said in a sermon one time, and I knew very well it wasn't what I meant to say. I was like, oh, I didn't say that, did I? You know, a couple of people I trusted said, yeah. And I'm like, well, I knew that one wasn't right, but I'd said it. So all you can do is get up and say, look, that's not what I should have said. Be willing to back it up if you need to. All right. Oh, we have one more. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's true. And we need to really mean it. All right. Well, chapter is one of the things that's interesting about chapter 11 is he's going to talk about the repopulation of Jerusalem. Well, this started back in chapter 7. In chapter 7, 4 and 5, now the city was large and spacious, but the people in it were few, and the houses were not rebuilt. Then my God put it into my heart to gather the nobles, the rulers, and the people, that they might be registered by genealogy. And then he goes on to talk about finding a register of those that came back in the first one. And he drops the whole thing about the people being few and registering the folks by genealogy till we get over here to chapter 11. Why did he drop it for all those times? I don't know. Don't know why he did. But what do they do? Well, verse 1, they cast lots. Now it says the leaders dwelt at Jerusalem. And then they cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 in. They kind of tithed the land, if you will. They said, let's bring in 1/10 of all the people and bring them into the city. Now, they already had some people there. But they're just saying, this is not enough. This is the city enemies are going to come after. We've rebuilt the walls, but we can't man the walls. We can't defend this city. And so they wanted them. And then it mentions that some people volunteered to move into the city. So they came in verse 2, they blessed those people that willingly offered themselves to dwell at Jerusalem. And then we have the book of Numbers. Nehemiah at times becomes the book of names. It names here. We have all these names of people who dwelt at Jerusalem. And I will tell you, if you had been of Jewish descent, living, say, about 200 B.C., you would have been delighted to have pulled out this book. And it wouldn't have been written in verses, but, you know, just to say, Nehemiah 11, verse 13, you see that Amashai? That was my great-granddaddy. He was one of those people. You know, to me, these names don't mean anything. It's just a long list of names of people that dwelt in Jerusalem. And in verses 25 through 36, some people who dwelt outside of Jerusalem. You know, none of that, it doesn't have great relevance to us. And this is one of those, if I were teaching Nehemiah to be teaching Nehemiah, I would still do about like I'm doing it right now. There's a long list of names. I hope you've read them. But verse 22 and 23 has something that stood out to me, where it speaks of the overseer, coming down to the end of the singers in charge of the service of the house of God, for it was the king's command concerning them that a certain portion should be for the singers, a quota day by day. You think about something here. The kings of Persia had not been overly receptive. You know, there were some times that they were hostile to the work of the Judeans here, the Jews now. They're not Judeans yet, because Alexander the Great hadn't come, but those of Judah. But now the king is ordering that a portion be given for the singers, which says to me something about Nehemiah again. How respected he had to have been by the king, that the king orders provisions to be made for this. Now, what do we learn from this? This is something, and we talked about this before, but Nehemiah, he sees a problem. The problem is actually stated back in chapter 7. The city was large and spacious, but the people in it were few. We need more people. We need more people. I wish we could come and live in this city. You know, what does that accomplish? Not a thing. You know, it may start there. You know, you're concerned, you're thinking, you're wringing your hands, but you got to have a plan. He came up with a plan. You know, there was a plan developed that we will cast lots. Now, I don't know if Nehemiah came up with this by himself in consultation with others, if somebody in the crowd suggested it, but a plan was developed for this. And so, you know, I think too often we confuse hope with a plan. You know, plans spring out of hope. But, you know, we just kind of hope things happen. You know, we just hope we have a Bible class program. We just hope that somebody is taught the gospel. We just hope that we, you know, stronger, you know, in our praying, in our knowledge. You know, well, I hope this year I learn more about the Bible. Okay? That's good. You're hoping that. How are you going to get there? Leaders don't just see a big picture. They have a plan. And then, again, I keep saying this because I keep seeing it. The leaders of the people dwelt at Jerusalem. You know, they wanted this city to be inhabited, and so they lived there. They set a good example. Thoughts, comments before we get to chapter 12. Exactly.
Nehemiah mentions all these people here. We kind of look over and can't probably pronounce most of them anyway, but in detail, he recognizes these people and records their names. He has them in positions of something. But, I mean, with a quill and some ink, and he wrote every name out like this. I mean, he could have just said so-and-so's associated.
That's a good point. And maybe we should actually go through and read all these names. But, who stepped up? Not, in a sense, maybe it comes back to something we've talked about. This is not theoretical. There were actual people involved. And then Nehemiah knew, like you said, he knew the names of these people. He recorded them. They weren't just a crowd of folks to him. Yeah. He does deal details there. Talking about names, chapter 12, we've got the names of the priests and the Levites. And some of this goes back to the time of Zerubbabel, and he calls it Jeshua here. Elsewhere he's called Joshua, the priest. Zerubbabel was the governor, and Joshua the leader. This is back about 536, 37 B.C. that they came back. They all came back, and we got all these names. They're significant, they're important, but not to our study tonight. They dedicated the wall. Now here is another one of those that's interesting kind of question that arises. They finished the wall back in chapter 6. We don't have the dedication of the wall to chapter 12, and he's narrated all of this, and the question is raised, well, why do they have the dedication now instead of back then? And I could go over several possible reasons for that, except when we get through with it, those would be several possible. I don't know. I just know that it's here. And the thing that stood out to me in this is that they were giving God the glory. The word dedication, when I saw it, I had to look the word up. I thought, well, I wonder if this is a Hebrew word somewhat like sanctification, that implied a whole, no. It meant taking ownership of, taking possession. It was like our grand opening, basically. You remember back in Deuteronomy, chapter 20, I believe it was, when they were going out to war, it said, if a man has built a house and not yet dedicated it, he was given an exemption for going to war right then. They were going to dedicate it. They were going to have the grand opening. Now, the wall's been up for a while. But this grand opening, if you will, this dedication was to thank God and to praise Him for its building. They knew from whence it had come. And it's a really neat picture, I think. I don't know how wide the walls were on the top, but it pictures they go up on the wall. And you've got two thanksgiving choirs, verse 31, large ones. Now, do remember their worship was different than New Testament worship. But they go, one goes to the right, one goes to the left. These choirs are going around the walls. And they give praise and, they meet together. They offered great sacrifices and rejoiced. For God had made them rejoice with great joy. The women and the children also rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard afar off. You could have been a distance away and heard the praising of God and what was going on here. And at the end of chapter 12, verse 44, they appointed some rooms for the offerings and the tithes. It gives some things, verse 45 and 46, about the singers and the gatekeepers made for them, and how they appointed the portion for them, that they were doing this. Verse 44, the very last part of it says, for Judah rejoiced over the priests and Levites who ministered. And he's connecting this with, they were giving their tithes because they liked what the priest and the Levites were doing. In the book of Malachi, just this is kind of a little aside, but it does relate. You remember I mentioned earlier, he said, you've robbed God in your tithes and your offerings. Do you remember what group of people come in for the greatest amount of criticism in the book of Malachi? It's the priest. The priests are excoriated for the way they do things, the sacrifices they offer, their failure to teach the people. You know, and in fact, he says, I'm going to take the dung of your sacrifice or the awful. Is there ever a better word than awful named? O-F-F-A-L, the innards of something. And, you know, they are awful, you know. So, I mean, that's just a great name. But he says, I'm going to take that and smear it on your faces. He says all that to the priest. And then he turns around and says, and you people who have not been paying your tithes, you're robbing God. And you want, well, some of the people going, well, hey, those priests aren't any good anyway, so I'm not going to pay my tithe. God said, you do your job. If the priests fail, priests fail. That's not theirs. But they were doing things right here in this time. They were providing for the workers. And so, you know, what do we learn from this? Well, the thing that stood out to me, if I can get it to go, and this is for all of us, but it's really a big lesson for leaders. If leaders follow God's word, they develop the kind of characteristics we see in Nehemiah, and they will do the things that he did, they should enjoy success. Success meaning not building up a physical wall, but truly building the house of God. There should be spiritual successes and victories. And what do we do? Do we go little Jack Horner and talk about what a good boy we are? Or do we give God the glory and the praise and the thanks? And you know, we've got to do our part. The leaders had to lead. The people had to be. Remember it said they had a mind to work. They had to do all those things. When the enemies were threatening them from outside, they had to work long hours with a weapon in one hand and a tool in the other. You know, not even able to change their. You know, they had to do all of that. But in the end, they understood it was fruitless apart from God. They gave God the glory. And, you know, there were Ezra, there were Nehemiah, there were all great people. And then, we'll come back again to the last point. My last point is one I've mentioned earlier. So I'll say, details matter. I thought I had more than that. Come back. Leaders have to be, in a sense, big picture people. They have to be able to see, you know, beyond today, you know, and see things. And I think that sometimes leadership drowns in details. We've all heard the expression paralysis by analysis. They're so consumed with all the details and getting all the details right that they never get anything done, because there'll always be something else that you could, you know, you can break it down a little bit further. But you look at something like this. You have these two large Thanksgiving choirs. Well, that can't be done without some planning. Some organization. Some of these people, it said they came in from outside of Israel. I mean, outside of Jerusalem, from the countryside. You know, they had this planned. Who would lead? Who would do what? Which way they would go? We've got to have, again, not just hope. Not just thinking, I wish we could do this. It starts with that. It starts with that vision, that big picture idea. But then you've got to come up with a plan for execution. Leaders don't execute the plan you know, by themselves. They don't do all these detailed things. You know, Nehemiah, Ezra couldn't do all the singing and all the playing of the instruments and all the offering of sacrifices. But they were in charge of seeing that it got done. And there has to be a certain amount of that.
It has always been, he that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man that built his house upon the rock. Floods came, went, blew, and so forth. And that was true with Nehemiah. Mm-hmm. It's always been true. He's hearing the sayings of the Lord and doing them.
Mm-hmm.
It
really is. And it's a, in the contrast, it's a foolish man that hears and doesn't do. That's right. Anybody else? Any thoughts? I mean, Paul. You know, the first, and that's where it's got to be for all of us, and especially, I mean, there's a special, we're making a special emphasis to leaders, but there in 1 Corinthians, really 1 through 4, that whole first four chapters is about that idea, and the way Paul attacks it is, you know, well, the two of us, yeah, we had a part to play, but we're just servants. And it's God who's over all. You know, and he goes on to, he said, it's God's field. You're God's building. And, you know, Acts 20, verse 28, when he's speaking to the elders there, he said, shepherd the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. The idea, and I'll tell you this, that should be a very sobering thought to elders. That, you know, you're not directors running a company. That's serious business. But these are people bought with the blood of Jesus. But I'll tell you what, you're not an elder. You know, you're sitting in the pew. There, you know, and you're looking around and you're going, you know, all these people that I sometimes struggle to get along with and that I don't do, they're all bought with the blood of Jesus. This is His church. This is not my club. You know, they don't all have to make me happy. They serve another master. And so, you know, remembering that would help us all an awful lot.
Mm-hmm. Moses suffered because of that, mm-hmm, drastically.
Yeah.
And that was also true of Aaron. They took Aaron out and he died and they buried him, mm-hmm, because he was in violation of the law of the Lord.
Yeah.
And that, we need to face that today. We come up with something that faces us in the church. What are we going to do? Are we going to follow the law of the Lord, or are we going to follow our own law? And God could say to us today, and I don't know but what He would say to us if He were to speak to us, because you believe not in me to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, you'll not, and so the consequences will be there.
Yeah. And I'll, You're mentioning Numbers 20 there with Moses. If when Moses went out there and he said, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring you water?" You know, there is no way that Moses didn't believe in God. You know, I mean, he, if you said, "Moses, do you believe the Lord exists?" Well, yes. "Do you believe that the Lord is one that's going to, only one that can bring water?" Of course. "But God said you didn't believe in me to sanctify." What do you mean? It means you didn't trust. First of all, just trust my instruction, and you didn't. Well, you put yourself up there with me. Must we? There was no we to it. It was God. You know, Moses and Aaron were putting themselves up there with God. And if we're not careful, we become protective of our turf. It's God's field. It's God's building. It's God's people. Those are the folks we're trying to help go to heaven, along with ourselves. Nehemiah was a man who cared about the people because he cared about God. You know, he loved the Lord his God. He loved his neighbor. We do those two things, we'll be good leaders. We have one more chapter. This, according to our original schedule, this should have been our last night. Are we going to go one more week and finish up? Y'all think? And we will. What I hope to do next time is finish chapter 13. Has some great material in it. Some of it will be stuff, a lot of it we've already talked about in some ways, but we will use it for review. And I want y'all to think about the points we've given and questions that you may have and things that, you know, and maybe some additional points. Maybe they're not from Nehemiah. You know, we've tried to bring some others in, but we will finish up chapter 13, first part of the class. Like I say, so much of it will relate to things we've already talked about. It won't take nearly the whole class to do that next time. Thank you so much for being part of this. I hope that it's helpful to you and help you draw closer to God and learn about leadership. All right, let's close with prayer. Wade, would you lead us in that, please?